It's time for another episode of Computers I Have Known, the occasional series where we talk about computers that basically were influential to me over time. In the last episode, we talked about how I had bought my first computer with my own money, an iMac DV, in the late 90s. Now we move forward just a few years to 2002. Computer technology was advancing so rapidly around the turn of the millennium. I would say it was probably the fastest time of really any kind of technological development that humanity has really ever seen, at least, you know, within a few decades. One could argue that we saw a lot of technology advancement coming out of World War II, that sort of thing. But for computers, as fast as things were moving in the 80s and early 90s, the late 90s and kind of early to mid 2000s, it was even faster. So to want to buy a new computer just 2 or 3 years after you bought your previous one was actually very normal compared to what we see today. So in 2002, I was just wrapping up my first year of college. I had taken that iMac DV with me to college, and it was fine. It did everything that I needed it to do, but it was starting to feel a little long in the tooth. Plus, there were changes going on that had me contemplating making a move. You see, in the late 90s, Steve Jobs had come back, and at Apple, the Mac OS by that point was a bit of a mess. The classic Mac OS, which a lot of younger people these days don't really have any experience with, or if they do, it's just kind of cursory. They never really had to live with it on a daily basis. The classic Mac OS was actually pretty buggy and somewhat archaic. I've talked about this in other YouTube episodes that I've done kind of in brief, but basically, if you were used to using the classic Mac OS, it was kind of obvious that Apple had just kept building on top of the original operating system written for the very first Macintosh. And that operating system was brilliant in what it was able to do given the hardware constraints of that very first computer, but it didn't scale very well over time. So there were some really inherent limitations. You can think of it kind of being along the same lines as, you know, how earlier versions of Windows were based on top of DOS. Mac OS wasn't like based on top of another OS or anything like that, but you could definitely feel how the underpinnings were perhaps a little bit rickety. It crashed an awful lot, and there were certain scenarios that you just kind of knew it was going to crash, dealing with things called system extensions, basically pieces of software that kind of hooked into the kernel of the OS to extend functionality or, in most cases, add hardware support, drivers, that sort of thing. Well, those were like the number one cause of Mac OS instability, but applications could be written in a bad way that could cause problems. These days, if you use a modern Mac or Windows or Linux computer, it's really no big deal if an application crashes, right? The program itself just kind of bombs out, you close it, but the rest of the OS stays up and you go, oh, well, okay, the application crashed, and you just kind of continue on with your work. Back then, especially in the Mac OS, but also this happened to Windows as well, like Windows 95, 98, that sort of thing. If an application crashed, oftentimes it took the OS down with it, meaning the whole computer would need to reboot. And if you had any other applications open at the same time, hopefully you saved your work, because otherwise all of that would be lost as well. So getting used to saving frequently was just kind of muscle memory when you were using computers from that era, you know, Command S, Control S, just like every couple of minutes, just so you didn't lose anything in case another app decided to die, was something you just got used to doing. And then also that whole multitasking thing, right? Like it was cooperative multitasking, meaning that by default, whatever program that was in focus could consume all of the computer's resources. And this did get better over the years with the classic Mac OS, but it was never perfect, right? You always had occasions where you tried to have multiple programs running and maybe one would be trying to do something kind of lightweight in the background, but the foreground app just stole all the resources, so those background apps just kind of got paused. Even competing with resources with the macOS Finder, its main graphical UI, right? You'd end up in a situation where you'd try to copy a file, and while the file was copying, you couldn't do anything else. Like, that's a foreign concept to us these days. Of course you can start up a big file copy and push it to the background and keep working on other stuff while it progresses. But back then, no, you had to wait. So the classic macOS by the late 90s, it had been steadily getting better, but it was just too far gone to really completely rewrite. Apple had multiple attempts over the years to completely rewrite the OS, but the company was too dysfunctional to be able to do it itself. And that was the entire point behind Apple buying Next, which was the company that Steve Jobs founded after he had gotten pushed out of Apple in 1985. So Next had a really good OS. At least the underpinnings of it were really good because it was based on Unix and it had been written in a much kind of cleaner way to think about all this kind of stuff. It was a high-performance OS, not so much like a consumer OS, but it could be used as a consumer OS if you wanted. So basically, Apple bought Next, and in the process, they got Steve Jobs, and you kind of know the rest of the history. But transitioning from the classic Mac OS to OS X, that was actually a pretty messy time period. And the reason is the first couple of versions of OS X that were like released to the public that you could install in your own machine and considered a production release, they actually kind of sucked. They had put a lot of work into it and they certainly looked really pretty, but there were a lot of features that were still missing because you could tell that Apple really only had a few years so far in to try and convert from Next Step into OS X. And it also really, really impacted people in terms of how slow it was. You could install OS X on a brand new Mac in 2001, and it would just crawl compared to running the classic Mac OS. The writing was on the wall that the classic Mac OS was going away. And Apple came up with clever ways to let you continue to use it, such as the classic environment, which was basically running the classic Mac OS in a virtual machine on top of OS X, with a really interesting way of integrating the two graphical UIs so that the desktop of the classic Mac OS would disappear and all you would see would be just like the windows of the running programs from within it. So you could have both these older apps and your new modern OS X apps running at the same time and command tab between them and that sort of thing. But it was still messy and it was a performance hog. And not a whole lot of Mac apps had made the transition to OS X early on. It took some companies a very long time. In fact, here's one that I remember very distinctly because it actually kind of affected me. You may remember in a previous episode, I mentioned that I went to college for journalism. As part of the classes that I took, I learned how to do page layout. Basically, if I were to go into the field of journalism, chances are I'd work in a newspaper. One of the options that I could take would be to pursue graphic design and page layout. So using applications like Quark Express and InDesign and PageMaker and all that to physically lay out what a printed news page would look like, because remember, we hadn't quite completely gotten into online news at that point. That was a skill that I would need to learn. So I was starting to learn that. And throughout the 90s, there were really kind of two main professional page layout programs that competed. There was Adobe PageMaker, and then there was Quark Express. Express was by far the more popular program, at least from what I can tell here in the US. PageMaker, it worked, and it definitely had its fans, but some people gave it the nickname Page Breaker because it didn't always quite work right. So Express was really, if you wanted to get anything done, that was what you did. So that's what I started to learn on. Quark as a company made a really interesting, interesting in quotation marks, decision in that it decided it didn't really want to pursue jumping on the OS X bandwagon right away. So it held off on coming out with an OS X native version of Express. And Express was kind of clunky running in that classic environment, the whole virtual machine thing. Ultimately, what happened was that decision to hold back support for, and we're not just talking like for the first year, we're talking for several years. It felt like it took Quark forever to come out with a version, like a native version of Express for OS X. And in that time, it actually gave Adobe a leg up to release a new product that it called InDesign. So it kind of moved away from PageMaker and into InDesign. InDesign was OS X native. And in my opinion, I think it actually did some things better than Express. But because we were starting to see, like, you need to move away from the classic Mac OS and embrace OS X, even though the whole graphic design and print industry, they were very hesitant about it. But they were also all power users. They needed high-performance Macs. And they knew that the brand new computers that they were going to buy in the next year or two that were high-performance, there's a good chance they wouldn't be able to run classic Mac OS at all. So begrudgingly, that entire industry embraced OS X. And as it did, it wanted to run native apps. So InDesign ended up actually kind of taking over in a way for Express, or at least leveling the field out. I remember as of about 2003, 2004 or so, when in the campus newspaper office, we got new machines that did run OS X. We're talking like PowerMac G4 Quicksilver kind of machines. We basically transitioned all over to InDesign, and I actually liked it. That was fun, dare I say it. Doing page layout and that was kind of fun. It was very intuitive and smooth, and I could wrap my head around it a little bit better than I could when I was dealing with Express previously. But that's a great example of kind of where things were at with the Mac platform in, say, 2001, 2002 or so. We weren't really fully on board with a particular Mac OS. We were trying to move away from classic, but some people were stuck using it. But we weren't fully on board with OS X because it was still very new and very buggy and very slow, and it would take a couple more years worth of releases to really have OS X feel good, feel complete, and perform well, and, you know, have decent feature set and all that. So I faced a bit of a dilemma. My iMac was 3 years old at that point, and it probably had some more life left in it. But at the same time, I had also taken a job on campus, you know, at the university I went to, working for the campus IT department. Just student work, you know, part-time, 25 hours a week kind of a thing. But we were also the kind of institution where we leased the majority of our computers. So it was a 3-year lease. And it was kind of on a rolling interval where 1/3 of all the computers on campus would get replaced every year. So that it wasn't like every 3 years we had to replace every computer on campus. So every summer, we had basically 3 months to go through and physically replace 1/3 of all the computers on campus. And that was still like a couple thousand computers. But, you know, we managed to do it. And so that, joining that department and starting to get that experience, that and of course just regular, you know, support, help desk calls, that sort of thing, Windows XP was very new at that time. And of course, being, you know, an enterprise kind of environment, previously the university computers had been running Windows 2000. So I had started to get some experience with that, but XP was the first Windows OS that was the same for both consumers and business users, right? Microsoft had kind of started to go down this split, and it wasn't a very clear split, but it was kind of through the 90s, it was turning into, if you're a home user, you bought a machine that ran Windows 95 or 98 or ME or whatever. And if you were a business user, especially if you were an enterprise user, you went down the path of Windows NT and Windows 2000. NT and 2000 were way more stable the 9598 because they weren't based on DOS. And that's really kind of the thing that had always frustrated me about Windows through the 90s was, you know, it really in some ways just kind of felt like a graphical UI on top of DOS with all the complexities and bugginess and everything that entailed, right? Like, not to say, like, as much as we were talking about how the classic Mac OS was kind of buggy, Windows was about as buggy in my experience. So it didn't really matter what kind of computer you used unless you shelled out for one of these business machines that ran either Unix, you know, at that time, because Linux was still really pretty small, or Windows NT kernel kind of stuff. You know, a buggy computer experience was really what you expected. XP really changed the game in that it unified kind of both of those tracks under the same OS. Now, of course, there was Windows XP Home Edition and Professional Edition, and they had some feature differences, but the kernel was the same between the two, and the same programs would run on both. For the most part, Microsoft, I think, did a good job also with backwards compatibility. Yeah, some of the really, really old DOS programs didn't work all that great on XP, but a lot of like Windows 95, 98 ME programs and games worked just fine. So XP was a very clear path forward. It was well supported. And the most important thing was it brought a ton of huge benefits right away. It wasn't that same weird buggy transition kind of period like we were seeing on the Mac OS. So I got to thinking, you know, around 2002, I think it was like the summer of 2002, and I'm deciding, what do I want to do? Do I want to try and ride it out with my iMac for one more year? Or do I want to jump on the bandwagon with, you know, the new Pentium 4 processors and more memory and go Windows? And I actually decided to go Windows. I decided, you know what, because I've got a decent amount of hardware at my disposal kind of through my work, you know, in the IT department, did I really need to own a Mac to keep up with how that transition was going? I decided, no, I didn't really need to. I should go with whatever tool worked best for me at that time. And all of the programs and everything that I needed to use, none of those were really Mac exclusive, right? There were Windows versions either of the same program or kind of an equivalent program that were available for Windows and XP native applications at that. So I decided, you know what, let's just do it. So the school I went to, the lease was generally through Dell. So we did definitely have Macs, and we leased our Macs, you know, in college, of course, as well. But all the PCs on campus were through Dell. So I had gotten some decent experience working with their hardware at that point. And despite the fact that I had spent several years through high school working at a computer store where we custom built PCs, I decided, you know, given the amount of free time I had on my hands and the fact that I was working really hard to try and save up a bunch of money to buy a new computer, I'd rather have something that had kind of an all-encompassing warranty to it instead of, you know, building my own custom PC that was exactly what I wanted, but if it broke and it was on me to get it fixed, and that would suck if I had homework that was due or whatever, right? So I decided, you know what? The Dell hardware looked good enough, and the pricing was pretty compelling, so I went and bought a pre-built. I actually bought a Dell. I ended up buying a Dimension 4500. I don't remember exactly how much I paid for it. I'd like to say the tower itself was probably $1,200, something like that. It was a 2.4 gigahertz Pentium 4. And it came with either 256 or 512 megabytes of RAM. Don't quite remember exactly how much. It came with a 80 gigabyte hard drive, I believe. And it had two optical drives in it, which was a very popular thing at the time. People kind of forget about that, but dual optical drives, especially with the MP3 era and all that going on, the whole rip, mix, burn, you know, burn your own mix CDs and all that becoming really affordable, the cost of CDRs just plummeting to being really cheap. A lot of people had two optical drives in their computers. So the one on the top bay was a DVD reader, which could, of course, also read CDs. And then the one below it was a CDRW drive. It couldn't read DVDs, it couldn't burn DVDs, but it could burn CDs. The idea was you could make duplicates that way, right? If you wanted to copy CDs, you stick the source in the top and a blank in the bottom, press go, and it would just do it on the fly. So those are the optical drives. I did not get a zip drive in that computer, but it had a floppy drive. The thing that I was actually really impressed by was I was used to seeing lots of computers by that point with integrated accessories, shall we say. Things like built-in video, built-in sound cards, built-in networking, you know, right on the motherboard. And generally, those kinds of chipsets, those parts, were relatively low quality, right? Integrated video would generally have been like low-grade kind of stuff, not very good for gaming. Built-in sound would have been like AC97, you know, just real kind of cheap audio chipsets. Built-in networking would have been a whatever kind of 10-100 card type of thing, right? What I was impressed by with this Dell was that it actually didn't have anything on the motherboard. The only ports on the motherboard itself were PS2, USB, and it was USB 1.1, because I don't think USB 2 existed at that point, parallel and serial, and that's it. Everything else, you had to stick in your own cards. So the machine was like upgradable, very upgradable right off the bat, which I was really kind of surprised by. It had an AGP video card in there, and I just can't remember what model it was. I'd like to say it was an NVIDIA card of some sort, probably 32 or 64 megabytes of video RAM. I don't remember buying like the highest end option at the time because Dell was all configured to order at that point. They were not selling at retail. You couldn't go to, you know, in 2002, you couldn't go to Best Buy or a brick and mortar store and buy a Dell. It was exclusively, you go to their website, you call them, and they build exactly what you want. So it was kind of like a mid-range video card at the time. It had a 10100 PCI network card. I think it was probably a 3COM, like a 3C905, very common card. And the sound card was a Sound Blaster Live, which was very nice. And it also had the header to plug into the front panel audio, so that worked well. And the front panel on that machine also even had a pair of USB ports, which I was kind of surprised by. One interesting, funny thing about the front panel on that machine was when the computer arrived, took it out of the box, excited to set it up, and I noticed the badge on the front actually said Dimension 8200. But I had ordered a 4500. So I'm sitting there thinking, whoa, did they give me, no way. They gave me, you know, and then I'm getting excited, right? They gave me a free upgrade because the 8200 was supposedly a much better machine. I'm thinking, oh, no way. I got a free upgrade, right? So I'm hurrying to get the thing all set up and I power it on, but it says it's a 4500, like in the BIOS. And all of the specifications that I remember buying were what the machine had. So I'm like, oh, no, they just put the wrong badge on the front. So there was like this initial kind of disappointment that, well, you know, I didn't get the free upgrade after all. And I ended up calling up support just to confirm, like, here's the service tag, the serial number, whatever, off the computer. You know, what did you actually send me? And they said, yes, we sent you a 4500. Here's all the specs, blah, blah, blah. So we confirmed I got what I paid for. And to their credit, they ended up overnighting me a new badge. Just a little piece of plastic that said 4500 on it instead of 8200. It was a little plastic ring that I think went around the power button on the front. They overnighted that to me. But that ended up actually being a good thing in the end because the 4500 used, I'd like to say, just regular DDR memory. It was either PC 133 or DDR. I can't quite remember. The 8200 used a different RAM standard called RDRAM, also known as RAM bus. It was something that some parts of the industry, mostly Intel, was trying to push, but it did not see much adoption, mostly because the RAM was way more expensive. And because it was way more expensive, people didn't want to buy it. And because people didn't want to buy it, not many companies made it. So it was a bit of a catch-22. So in the end, me getting the lower end machine, which was really kind of a mid-range machine at the time, getting that one instead of getting that free upgrade that I had kind of hoped would happen ended up being a blessing in disguise because it meant the computer I got would have been much more affordably upgraded over time. And I did. I ended up putting like 1 or 2 gigabytes of RAM in that computer over the next few years, and it didn't cost me a whole ton of money to do it. So Dimension 4500, it came with Windows XP on there. I learned all about XP. And the other thing that I decided to splurge on, because I had been working really hard as a student worker, I mean, I just got as many hours as I possibly could. A lot of, you know, my friends and peers in college, when they had free time, they'd go and just screw around and blow it on whatever, right? They'd go party or anything. They'd blow their money on random stuff. I decided to save it so that I could buy a new monitor as well. And instead of getting some random CRT, I decided to splurge. LCD monitors were really starting to take off. They were still kind of expensive, but the quality of the panels was improving dramatically to the point where people were seeking out LCDs. And the prices were falling sufficiently that they were starting to become affordable. So I did a little bit of a baller kind of move, and I bought a 17-inch LCD in 2002. Not very many people did that. Because if you did have an LCD on your desktop, it was going to be a 15-inch, because those were a lot more affordable. But I decided I wanted the bigger, you know, the higher resolution, the more screen real estate to work. So I bought a 17. The monitor cost as much as the computer. But it was glorious. I loved that monitor. It was just so nice compared to dealing with CRTs at the time. Was it a ton of money? Yes. Could I have spent that money on better things? Probably. But I'd worked really, really hard and saved up for a long time. And some of that money was money I'd saved up from like high school, you know, working at the computer store. But I bought that monitor. So I had this complete set and it was really cool. And despite the fact that, you know, in I guess another timeline, I would have preferred to have continued to use a Mac, I actually had a really good time with that computer. Windows XP proved to be a lot more stable than like Windows 98, you know, or ME or 95 or whatever, right? Moving to the NT kernel for the consumer OS was, I'll say, Microsoft's smartest move, the smartest thing that company had ever done. Because suddenly now you have people that don't actively hate their computer so much anymore. I mean, it could still be a confusing experience dealing with Windows and, of course, having to worry about viruses and all that kind of stuff. But overall, the computer was way more stable. Instead of having to reboot your computer multiple times a day and being in the habit of shutting it down when you weren't using it, you now go to the point where you can have the computer up and running for weeks at a time without even needing to reboot it. It was that big of a deal. And again, it sounds like the most trivial thing these days because we've been used to that for decades now. How often do we reboot our computers? It's usually just to install like software patches, right? Even a, you know, even the crash of an application usually isn't enough for us to need to reboot the whole thing. Back then, being able to go from having to reboot 2 or 3 times a day due to system instability to once every couple of weeks, and that every couple of weeks was really just a maintenance reboot because we were still just a little paranoid about, you know, trying to push it longer than that and having an app crash on us and lose our work or whatever. That was a huge deal. Of course, the UI was controversial. Some people called it the Fisher-Price interface, but I liked it. I think it was fun, and it kind of kept with the times in terms of what was going on and graphic design and the whole translucent plastics and all that kind of thing. I think it was really fun. And yeah, I ended up keeping that machine until, I'd like to say, 2007. So it actually had a decent amount of life to it. I got 5 years out of that computer, despite the fact that, you know, progress was continuing to be made and whatnot. But even though I still learned a lot about what was going on with the Macs, just kind of casually through my job and seeing new computers come in and learning how OS X was evolving and getting better and all that, I'd say that switching to Windows XP was like the right decision at the right time, because it also set me up for the career that I'm on today. learning how not just the OS works, but also how does it integrate into a network, right? In college, that was the first really big network I ever had experience with. I had learned about setting up little small home networks when, like in 2000, we switched from dial-up at home to DSL. And of course, getting DSL meant that you could have multiple computers share that internet connection. Of course, you needed to buy extra stuff to do it. Routers and switches, or at that time, hubs, and cabling and network cards and all that kind of stuff. I had kind of learned about how all that worked, but I didn't know things like Active Directory or Microsoft Exchange or file servers or any of that kind of stuff. So having my own Windows PC, you know, in my dorm room, later my apartment, that I could tinker with on my own, plus what I learned on the job, really set me up to better understand how all that stuff worked, so that when I graduated and it became clear that the journalism industry was just an absolute mess at the time, switching to my backup plan of working with computers became feasible because I already had a lot of knowledge and I was able to go into my first job saying, yeah, this is my first real full-time job, but look at all my experience so far. You know, I had 7 years between high school and college of experience working with computers, hardware and software, and the last four of them were dealing with enterprise level stuff. So as much as I kind of missed having a Mac at home, because that was still probably the platform I was a bit more comfortable with, kind of taking that leap of faith and getting a Dell, and dude, you're getting a Dell, that ended up being a very smart move for me in the end. And I've continued to follow both platforms ever since, hopefully with equal weight, right? I'm not trying to prefer one over the other. Yeah, my daily driver these days is a Mac, but I always own a modern PC. And in a future episode of this series, we'll talk about how that journey kind of continued. We're nearing the end of the series because after my college era, we kind of get into just commodity PCs that are starting to get to be a bit too new to really consider retro or vintage or whatever. But that Dell, you know, it was a good change. It was what I needed at the time. It was like my own kind of bridge technology. I may not have wanted to stay on PCs full time as my daily driving computing platform for years and years and years. But in terms of what I needed to just get work done and set me up for success, I have no complaints. As always, thanks for listening.